Our first bill is Senator Higgins, but I don't see her here. So, Senator Saxog, are you ready to go?
We are, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog, Senate File 68 is before the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's what we're presenting, Senate File 68. This is a sales tax exemption for Itasca County to help upgrade its 800 megahertz communication system. As a little background, I think we understand the significance of these systems on a statewide basis. There was six phases. The first three phases have been completed, and they include roughly the metropolitan area in Stearns County and St. Cloud and Sherburne County and Wright County around the St. Cloud area, and then the Olmsted County and the City of Rochester in that particular area. Phases 4, 5, and 6 have yet to be completed. Itasca County is in Phase 6, and Itasca County has taken it upon itself to build a system on its own using county tax dollars to make it happen. And what we want to do here then is, again, is help them out with the sales tax exemption. With me today is Sheriff Pat Maduri. He's going to give some testimony on why this exemption is crucial to the public safety infrastructure of Itasca County.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Itasca County is building a new communication system that will affect all public safety in Itasca County. As Senator Saxog said, we're actually ahead of the state of Minnesota in build out of the system. Itasca County is included in Phase 6, and the state has completed Phase 1, 2, and 3 so far. Our system was in dire need of repair. Anywhere from 40-year-old equipment to the newest equipment was 24 years old. Our project is approximately $9.4 million to make happen. The county has taken the lead in bonding dollars to make the project happen. We hope to have the project up and running by the end of the year. In turn, we'll also be bringing on other entities within Itasca County. There's some public works departments. We've had conversations with the four school districts as well as the four hospitals. There's other county divisions, county road and bridge engineers, assessors, land department, probation, and as well as the sheriff's office that will be going on the system. Overall, the sales tax exemption has taken place down in the metropolitan area, down out in Rochester and Stearns County area, and affected the counties in the surrounding area. So we're asking to be tagged on to the current legislation that's in place already, which is Statute 297A.70, and we'd like to have Itasca County added on to that so that we could take part in the sales tax exemption, as well as the other counties that are already listed there.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Saxon.
I think it's important to note that not only is most of the equipment that's being replaced here old, but large parts of Itasca County, which is about 2,000 square miles in area, were not being served at all, and are not being served at all at this particular time. So this will increase the area that's being served, and in fact include all the police departments and fire departments in the county.
Any questions from the committee? Would anybody like to testify on the bill? Thank you, Senator Saxog. Senate File 68 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. Thank you, Sheriff, for coming down. How are the roads?
Terrible. We had another 2.5 inches last night, so.
In Grand Rapids?
Yes.
How much did you get total?
We're probably pushing 10.
Really?
So, yeah, okay. 8 to 10.
God's country on Lake Vermilion, I don't think we got 2 inches.
Oh, no. Really? Well, hopefully this will help our snowmobile winter tourist season a little bit.
Should.
Skiing.
Anybody watching out there, there's lots of snow up north, so pack your sleds. Thank you, Sheriff. Thanks for coming
down.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
I got 28.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins has Senate File 836. Members?
Did you get the fiscal note that,
Yes, we have one that says in 8 months of FY08, it's $850,000 would be collected, and in FY09, $1.29 million.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate File 836 will look familiar to you since I think I had it in the previous biennium. It would impose a 5 cent per gallon tax on paint sold in the state, and those collected revenues would be used for lead risk assessment and lead hazard reduction activities that the state does. The funds would be distributed with priority to areas where children and pregnant women are at greatest risk of lead poisoning. In Minnesota, 1.2 million homes contain some sort of or some amount of lead-based paint. The most common source is paint made before 1978. Paint made before 1950 may have very high levels of lead. For instance, in my old Victorian house built in 1900, there's lots of lead paint in that house. Unfortunately, we've known since the 1940s that lead is toxic. Lead-based paint was banned in Europe in 1940, but it was continued to be sold here until about 1978. As we saw tragically last year, if children ingest a high level of lead, they can die. Other possible effects of lead poisoning in children include lowered intelligence, decreased coordination, shortened attention span, aggressive behavior, and reading and other disabilities. Even adults can become lead poisoned. There are a lot of activities that people may do for fun or for their profession that may make the adults come in contact with too high an amount of lead for even an adult body. For instance, if you are if you work in a foundry, if you are work in a manufacturing company for ceramics and plastics, if you manufacture fishing tackle, if you're a firing range instructor or a janitor there, plumbers and pipe fitters even get too much lead. In 2004, 102 Minnesota adults had blood lead tests of 25 micrograms per 100 milliliters or greater. Early symptoms in adults are a little different. It's fatigue, lack of concentration, stomach cramps, poor appetite, irritability, nervousness, depression, headache, sleeplessness, a metallic taste in your mouth, high blood pressure, and muscle and joint pain. There are several lead-related bills that have been introduced this year in the Senate. Senator Berglund has one. I have a couple of them. And the funds raised in this bill will help pay for those activities to protect young Minnesotans. Linda Bremer from the Department of Health is here to, if you have any questions about what kind of activities the state already does. We work really hard at it. The department's got a lot of information they put out in many languages to help families understand how they can avoid lead poisoning and how to clean up the sources of lead in your home. But that all costs money. And so this is my attempt to find a little resource that would help us with those activities.
Members, any questions? Anybody from the committee with questions for the department? Senator Higgins, high blood pressure, muscle joint pain, I have both of those things.
I do too.
And when I was in elementary school, I remember a kid had a really sharp pencil and he poked me in the arm. You think maybe I have some elevated blood from being poked by that pencil about 48 years ago?
Mr. Chair, I think that was graphite. I think that wasn't lead.
Wasn't lead?
No.
It said lead pencil on it, number
it says
two,
lead pencil. That's right. And that's what we always called them. But if the house you grew up in was, an older house, you may have had some effects of that. You know, people always used to talk about children, little infants and toddlers, chewing on the windowsills. What we found, I think, more accurately is that the dust that's the microscopic dust that's created when you open and close a window and it's lead paint rubbing against lead paint, it's that kind of thing that is very dangerous to young children.
Does anybody in the committee know, do we still call them lead pencils?
Do you have one
number
in your folder?
Number two lead?
Yes.
Number twos.
Those are the soft ones, right?
Well, that was the ones you always had to use to take the tests when you had to fill in on the circles. That's what I remember.
Senator Moy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, a 5 cent per gallon doesn't seem like a lot, but in total, I mean, do we have any idea how many gallons of paint get bought and sold or shipped to Minnesota by the wholesalers? And then the second question is, so we charge this on paint that's manufactured here in Minnesota, but if someone else ships the paint from elsewhere to Minnesota, we impose the tax too, right? Is that what this does?
Mr. Chair, the first question is, if you look at the fiscal note, the department found that 1,338,500,000 gallons of paint, lacquer, varnish, were sold in calendar 2000 year nationwide. And they calculated that Minnesota, based on population, had 1.75% of that in sales. So this isn't paint just made in Minnesota. It's paint sold in Minnesota. That's what the fiscal note's based on.
Senator Higgins, is there any, you mentioned pipe fitters. I know years ago, before the advent of plastic pipe, they used cast iron pipe and oakum and lead to fill the joints.
Mm-hmm.
We must have a lot of that in houses, you know, dating back to World War II and before. Is there any risk from that?
Mr. Chair, I think if you were in the business of, plumbing and pipe fitters, if you were taking out the old pipe and putting and replacing it with the plastic pipe that people use now, if you're not careful, yeah, I think that is a dangerous thing, a dangerous profession to be in. I think a lot of the building trades are at risk for this.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the risk from that is from drinking the water. If the water sits there and it can pick up lead contamination, I think that's part of the reason we have drinking coolers all over the Capitol is because of the...
A shrinking... I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I think the reason we have the drinking coolers in the Capitol building is because of the lead pipes and as the water, if you don't flush it all out, you can have lead contamination from the water.
And Mr. Chair, there's the Department of Health has a wonderful two-page brochure. They call it Take Home Lead, and it's a hazard. Where the adults who are in the professions who do that kind of work, they may come home and carry the lead dust back to their families. And I found a really good brochure about how they can prevent endangering their kids if they do any of these kinds of activities. The brochure also talks about soldering of electric circuits. Those of us with old houses are kind of perpetually doing home remodeling and renovation and replacement, and you come across all those kinds of old things as well.
Anything else from committee members? Senator Higgins, let me give you some accolades this morning. Just about everybody comes to this committee with an idea of something they want to fund, and they ask for general fund money. To your credit, at least you've identified a funding source for the program you'd like to fund. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much.
Would anybody else like to testify in support of the bill? Would anybody like to testify in opposition?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Tax Committee. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Hans Hirschfield.
Welcome. Go ahead and continue.
I'm with Hirschfields Incorporated, which is a privately held, locally owned company based out of Minneapolis. And we are in the decorating business. We have 35 retail outlets within the state of Minnesota, as well as a manufacturing, coatings manufacturing facility located in Minneapolis on the north side, 45th and Lindale Avenue North. And I am here to communicate that we are opposed to the 5 cent taxation on Koenig's manufactured here in Minneapolis, or Minnesota in the state. We do not and never have manufactured coatings with lead content in the composition of the product. We have been manufacturing products since 1982. Our company, however, has been in existence for 112 years. And we feel that it would be a misrepresentation of taxes towards the lead issue that a number of industries contributed to over the many years. It would put us at a tremendous unfair competitive advantage, as in so far as we manufacture product for other industries nationally as well as internationally. We do business in China and Japan, where our competitors would have a price competitive advantage in terms of the tax that we'd have to pass on to our consumers. We also work with a number of outlets that work on the encapsulation of lead from a paint manufacturing standpoint. We do this as a good steward of the industry, as well as having grown up here in Minneapolis all my life. I feel it's our corporate responsibility to ensure as much as we can the possibility of making our homes safe. There are a number of industries, as Senator Higgins pointed out, that contribute to lead. The child that passed away, unfortunately, last year was a jewelry incident. If you look along our state highways, a large amount of lead is contained in the soils that line our freeways from the years of lead burning gasoline. So we feel that it would be a tremendous disadvantage for this tax to be applied to Hirschfields as well as other manufacturers of coatings in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
My name is Jason Bodekheimer. I'm a chemist. I'm with Hirschfield as well. I'm here to oppose the bill. I just want to emphasize and support Hans's comments. Hirschfields and Hirschfields Paint Manufacturing has never made a lead-containing product since its existence. So this would be taxation in which we haven't contributed to the cause or to the source of the lead.
Mr. Hirschfield, you mentioned that your company works with on lead encapsulment projects and actually donates paint. Have any idea, I mean, how much paint a year your company might donate to try and mitigate lead hazard?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I don't have that information, but a substantial amount is contributed to the cause by not only Hirschfields but other manufacturers within the region. We have been actively participating in the program for a number of years, so I would venture a guess into the hundreds and hundreds of gallons.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hirschfield. Just so I can get a little perspective of what kind of percent tax this would be, I mean, a gallon of paint is about $10 or so at the store. I mean, I suppose your cost is around $5. So would this be like a 1% tax on the paint supplies? Is that about right?
Senator, that's approximately correct. We have obviously varying raw material costs, can, carton, label with specific products, but in some instances more than 1%, but as a general rule around 1%.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hirschfield, I heard you say that you were marketing internationally, and your concern is that that would put you at a competitive disadvantage with other suppliers of coatings.
Yes.
Understanding that? Correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy, I've bought paint at Hirschfield's.
Thank you.
It's a nice paint.
We appreciate your business. It's pretty upscale, Mr. Chairman.
And, well, there's one very close to where my apartment is down here, but Senator Scoy must have a different salesman than me because I know I didn't pay $10 a gallon for it. So we've got to have a discussion afterwards which one of the stores you're shopping at.
I want his discount as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was shopping at the True Value in Clearbrook, and they're probably not using quite the same coating quality, maybe.
It is very good paint.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Again, we appreciate your
business. Wondering why you don't have a store in the range.
We're looking at it.
You have one in Duluth?
No, I'm talking to someone as we speak, as a matter of
fact. You have one north of Maplewood?
Yes, we do, but it's a contractor service center.
Oh, okay.
But we're happy to ship paint anywhere if freight will allow.
This time of the year, there are a lot of vehicles going back and forth.
I'm going to get emails this afternoon from my paint stores up north. I can see it coming.
We do have a dealer in Virginia, I think, Range Paint.
They're the best.
Bemidji, we have a store.
You can't find a better paint store than Dale Saber. He's a constituent of mine. He lives on Hibbing Point on Lake Vermilion, and they do a very good job. And they sell Hirschfield paint along with Pratt & Lambert.
Yeah, exactly.
How about the Two Harbors one?
I've never bought any paint in Two Harbors, but
it is a terribly.
Mr. Chair,
pardon.
I was just going to ask, Mr. Chair, have you ever bought a brush? No, that's the important element of painting.
To tell you the truth, I hate painting, and I generally try to pass that off on my wife when I can. She does a pretty good job at it, better than I would do.
Well, Mr. Chair, when I was growing up, we grew up two blocks from a Hirschfield's in Edina. I was always the first to volunteer to go get the needed supplies during the project because I didn't like wielding the brush any more than you did.
I'm a carpenter, so I'm better at making sawdust. Senator Higgins, can you tell we only have four bills up and we have some extra time this morning? Thank you. Anything else to add?
No, I thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming down, and members, without objection, we'll lay over Senate File 836 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
They don't really put lead in paint anymore nowadays, do they?
It's gone in the 70s. What was their point? We're not causing any problems.
Senator Moi, Senate File 800.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this Senate File 800 is almost a technical correction that will cost a little bit of money. But in 2001, we made it possible for owners and developers of affordable rental housing to be exempted from paying the sales tax on construction materials that are used for construction improvement of the property. And the categories of individuals who are eligible were nonprofit developers, a public housing agency, a housing redevelopment authority, a privately owned public housing, or a limited partnership where the general partner is a PHA or HRA. The only category excluded from the exemption is a nonprofit acting as a sole or a managing general partner within a limited partnership using low-income housing tax credits. The exemption, if we choose to put it on, would save about $2,400 per unit. The cost to the state would be about $1.5 million annually. Mr. Chair, in 2005, this would have assisted 620 units of housing to be built in 13 projects. I have with me today Mr. Alan Arthur, who is the president of the Central Community Housing Trust, who can explain in greater detail the complexity of the financing packages that allows for a nonprofit to develop affordable rental housing.
Senator Watt, the fiscal note we have is different from the number you just stated. It looks like in 08-09, according to revenue, the cost would be about $1.3 million for the biennium, and in 10-11, about $1.46 for the biennium.
And Mr.
Do you have
Chair,
some different information than what you gave us?
Well, Mr. Chair, this information I had gotten earlier from estimates, so I actually haven't had a chance to look at the fiscal note from revenue.
Cuts the cost of your bill about in half, revenue did.
I'm happy with that, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to object to that. But these, my numbers were estimates.
Yeah, very good.
That we'd gotten earlier, so.
And you have somebody to testify?
Mr. Alan Arthur.
Mr. Chair, committee members, again, I'm Alan Arthur, and I'm the president, CEO of Central Community Housing Trust, and we are a nonprofit organization that does affordable housing. One of the leading nonprofits, I think, in the state of Minnesota. And I'm here just to talk basically a little bit about the technical ways that affordable housing is principally done in not only the state of Minnesota but across the country. The primary tool to do affordable housing is called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. It's a federal tool that's passed down through states. It's allocated and monitored by Minnesota Housing, the state housing finance agency, sometimes sub-allocated to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. But primarily, it is a tax credit for corporations to get if they invest in affordable housing. It represents right now approximately 50% of the total capital that we use to provide affordable housing in the state of affordable housing units in the state of Minnesota and, again, across the country. That tool, however, requires for nonprofits like us to set up limited partnerships. They are for-profit limited partnerships, but we are either the managing general partner or the sole general partner of those limited partnerships. And it seems to us that since the number one tool to provide affordable housing is this low-income housing tax credit, that the legislation in 2001 just missed from a technical standpoint that little fine point that we put together these rather complicated but very productive partnerships in order to actually produce most of the affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. And so we're hopeful that we can make this, as the senator said, this really somewhat seems to us technical change if the intent was to really impact affordable housing in the state, so that nonprofits who are the sole general partner or the managing general partner of these limited partnerships can also take advantage of the tax break that was passed in 2001. Again, this is the largest production tool. It's common that we are the general partners or managing general partners, and I want to point out that would be a slight additional technical change that would have to be made to the legislation to say managing general partners to make it work productively and universally. Give you one example. We're working on a development in Chaska called the Chaska Marketplace. It was originally called the Chaska Sinclair development. In that particular development, it would save us approximately $136,000 on taxes. That's significant to folks like us who are out there. We typically put together somewhere between 12, 20, 30 different sources of funding to make these deals work. That's time-consuming, complex, not very streamlined for the state, and anything we can do to make it easier would be great. We just set a record at Central Community Housing Trust for HUD for sources of funding in a single affordable housing development project with 30. It's just very, very complicated, and the more streamlined and easier we can make it, the better. There's some questions about whether we truly control these general partnerships or these limited partnerships, and the truth is the purpose of this language is to make sure that we are in control. They're not sham limited partnerships in any way. They are bona fide, and that they are controlled, and the oversight is from Minnesota Housing for not only the first 15 years, but for an extended use term of 30 years beyond that. And so with that, maybe I'll leave it open to any questions that people might have.
Mr. Chair, I believe that there's an amendment. Ms. Allen, is there an amendment to add the language about a managing general partner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, no, there it's not.
Oh,
but
it's
if
not.
It's just to add managing, we could just perhaps do it. It's all right with the chair as a verbal amendment.
Okay. I was concerned that technical word was left off to make sure that it was.
Where is it going?
Council, to get to where the author would like to be.
Mr. Chair, page 1, line 18, after general, add or managing.
Mr. Chair.
Understand the amendment. Senator Squay.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, I understand that if there's a sole general partner, they have, 100% control. But if you're a managing partner, what is the process for determining who has control and who has ownership? And what can you explain a little bit more about what this is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, these limited partnerships consist usually of two partnership areas or entities. It's the general partner and the limited partner. And in some cases, for example, in a case in Minneapolis right now, we're partnering with another nonprofit, happens to be another nonprofit organization in a project. We're the managing general partner of that deal. That means we get to make the decisions about what happens to the project in the short term and long term. We get to make the decisions about how the limited partnership goes forward, whether it stays affordable housing or not, those kinds of things. Even if we didn't make the right decisions, though, in those cases, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has kind of a fairly large hammer over our heads to make sure we make the right decisions regarding that. We sign legal agreements with them to ensure that for not only 15 years, but an additional 30 years beyond that. So I don't know if I explained the question, Mr. Chair.
Well,
Senator Scho, but
Senator Scho.
And Mr. Chair, so if you were a nonprofit and you had a 10% stake in this partnership, and all the other percentage were for profit, how would that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scho, actually, we still have total control over the project. As a matter of fact, we actually are 1% general partners, and the limited partners, who are for-profit investors, are the 99% partners. Not to scare you off, but that's done so that they can get the tax benefits. That's the whole idea of the way the federal government has passed this law, put this together. But in a limited partnership, from a legal standpoint, they can't, by law, by RS decree, control the partnership. They can't.
Thank you. Senator Orban.
Mr. Chair, to clarify, they would have control over some of the business decisions, but not control over the profits or the money-making aspect. So if they're 90%, the general partner could be a 1% holder making some of the business decisions. However, the 99% for-profit members, the limited partners, are the ones that earn the dividends and take over any profits at the end, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, actually, no. The answer is no, not in our deals. But that's a little more complicated. Our limited partnership agreement makes sure that the benefits principally accrue to the affordable housing project itself. That's our way of making sure it stays affordable housing, not only for that first 15 years, but for the 30 years. From an IRS standpoint, though, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, you are correct. There is a fiduciary responsibility to ensure maximize the gain of any limited partner investor. In practicality, the way it's done, again, not only in the state of Minnesota but across the United States, is to make sure that the limited partnership agreement does not allow that to happen so that any excess monies gets actually funneled back into the project itself and not into limited partner investors.
Senator Ortman.
Chair, does the partnership agreement get filed with the governing agency here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, it does.
Mr. Chair, in every case?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, that's correct.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, are there any requirements with respect to what the contents are and the arrangements between the limited and the general partners?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I'm not sure that there are or not, but there should be.
Senator Moore moves on line 1.18 after an oral amendment, afterward general, insert or managing, and continue the sentence. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
After no motion prevails, bill's amended. Sure. Senator Pogomar.
Senator Moy, on the handout?
Yes.
There's a typo, I think, in under here's the reality. It says in 200, nearly 300,000. Do you know what year that is? Is that 2000 or 2005 or?
Mr. Chair, I understand that that may be in 2005.
Five, you think?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions, members? If not, without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 800 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Orban.
If I could just make a comment. I think that the concept of affordable housing and trying to find ways to meet the need are really important. But if we don't have protections or assurance that these sales tax exemptions are going to be cost savings for the development of the affordable housing, it's really hard for me to think of this as a priority. If the sales tax exemption could equally be turned around to just be profits for the profit-making partner in this organization. As meritorious as the affordable housing effort is, I just worry about whether that's the highest priority for the use of these dollars when we've got cities and counties and others that are trying to build and cannot avail themselves of the sales tax exemption. I think I hope that the committee will look at that and the questions of priority when it goes to bring the bill together.
Senator Ortman, there's all, you know, coming out of the construction industry, I've always questioned whether these savings actually indeed get passed on, especially where projects are negotiated, not competitively bid.
Mr. Chairman?
Probably a Senator Pogomar.
I think we do need some clarification. Why would someone be a limited partner in a 99% 1% deal? We understand they want the tax break. Why is it in the public interest to allow that? I think we just need to have a better sense of what's the reason for that.
Mr. Chair.
Because clearly they took on the general partner to get the tax break. And at first blush, you kind of go, well, that's not really what we're trying to do here. So give us, a more clarifying explanation of why this makes sense from a public policy. Why does this give us more affordable housing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogomiller. Again, to take a slight step back, and bear with me just for a second here, please. These tax credits were passed by the federal government in 1986 for the sole purpose of creating affordable housing. And what they do is basically there's an allocation process that goes through the state. Every state gets a certain amount of them, first of all, $1.85 per population, actually. And the state puts together an allocation procedure for the kinds of projects it will allow or will be eligible for this tax to get this tax break. So basically, each state has a bunch of pieces of paper that says here's a right to reduce taxes. It's actually that limited partners doesn't choose us to get the tax break. We choose them so we can get the tax break for the project that we're putting in place. So, for example, let's say in the city of Chaska, using the marketplace development as an example, we are working with the city of Chaska to do an affordable housing development. It's going to include so many units of affordable housing. We actually propose to the state that we'll be eligible for that tax credit, that tax break, through their allocation process. It is, again, 50% totally. It is 50% of the total capital, not 100%. At 50% of the total capital. So if a unit to produce it costs $180,000, for example, it typically will, the tax break will provide about $90,000. And here's how it does that. We get the tax break from the state. It's a piece of paper to us. It doesn't do us any good as a nonprofit. We don't pay income taxes. We form a limited partnership. We're the general partner, the controlling partner of that partnership. We go out and find limited partner investors who are interested in investing in something like this, and we sell them the piece of paper for their investment of approximately 50 or 55%, say, in the current marketplace. And it is both it's a competitive marketplace. It's an investment tool like anything else. We sell that to them, and we get about $90,000, an example that I just gave, from them at closing to help build the $180,000 of property. Now, unit. Now, how does this help that?
So instead, instead of that $90,000 going into their for-profit development, they instead turn over the $90,000 to you to do a nonprofit development.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogue, I don't. Their $90,000 is strictly there to buy the tax break, and many of them are investment pools, sometimes direct investments like U.S. Bank, Wells Fargo, also. They're just investing, and rather investing in a bond or investing in something else, they see this as an investment tool for their investment world. They also get, in the case of banks, CRA credits, which they need. It's a whole other complicated piece. But just to point out that that still only provides 50% of that $180,000 cost of producing that unit. We still have to raise the other $90,000, say, in this example that I'm giving, from other sources, from those other 15 sources, 20 sources, 30 sources, depending on the situation. And one of the ways we do that, one of the ways we hope to do that, is $2,400 per unit based on this average from this source. That would be $2,400 of the other $90,000. We still got some more to go, obviously, but that's how it would help. Again, we are the controlling entity here, not the investors. The investors are almost silent.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you can't sell them this investment vehicle, they will take that their own $90,000 and invest in something else, not affordable housing. Is that what the trade-off is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, that would be true. Although I will say this piece of paper is it's a competitive marketplace. They bid against each other, and you know, right now they've recently been paying somewhere between $95 and $1.02 per dollar of the tax break they get. They're getting about a 5 or 6% rate of return over the last 2 or 3 years. It's rising slightly now because of the marketplace, but yes.
And then, Mr. Chairman, and why would a developer do this? Because they, to get a larger development in a city like Chaska, they need to provide some affordable units to get the entire development? Or what's the motivating force to choose that investment vehicle versus a different one?
Mr. Arthur.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, it's not developers that are investing in this.
Okay.
It is corporations that principally are investing in this. We're the developer. These aren't developers that are investing in this. These are corporations that are investing in this. And the federal government created this tool for that exactly that to happen, so that corporations would invest in affordable housing in our country. And so we're the developer. We're the controlling entity again.
Senator Limmer.
Pass.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a financial investment. And they're either going to get a return on their money or they're not going to get a return on their money. They're not running the organization. It's just hands off. We'll give you our money, you use it, and here's what we'll get as a return. But my question is, it's been a valuable investment over time without this sales tax exemption. You've had partners, and they make money off of this. Why should we extend a sales tax exemption if they've been making money as an investment tool over time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, the proposed change here, the proposal here is not to get them to be create a greater incentive for them to invest in these projects. They're going to get what they get no matter if this goes through or not. The proposal here is to help us. It was our understanding that the original bill in 2001 was to help affordable housing happen. And because I don't think, frankly, that the legislature quite understood the number one tool for affordable housing in the country, the language wasn't written to have most affordable housing projects take advantage of the sales tax exemption. So this just allows us to help cure the other $90,000, not the first $90,000 that comes from the investors. You're right that the investors are going to come in any case, as long as we can raise the other $90,000. This is just going to help us as the developers of affordable housing to make the whole thing happen a little easier. That's quite frankly it.
Mr. Chair, you're right. Mr. Chair, also what it does is if you didn't have a investor base, nonprofits that are trying to create low-income housing would be limited to a variety of projects. This also gives you, it kind of leverages out your your resources a little bit so that you can, the nonprofit housing industry can expand their
their opportunities a little bit. Sometimes that takes advantage of pricing, and at least pricing in construction never seems to go down. It's always going up. You also have regulations, much like our classic example is our energy code that comes along, and that increased the price of each housing unit anywhere from $8,000 to $13,000. That was a few years back. But there's always something happening in the housing construction that keeps putting more and more expenses into the market. Sometimes you want to move fast to catch a faster moving sales market. And so all of these things can create an incentive to do that. It gives a little more flexibility to a nonprofit in order to build only a narrow field of housing. They don't have the opportunity to go up the scale to take advantage of other markets. They're kind of stuck for a customer base. And so I suggest that we give them as many tools as we can to give them a greater flexibility, if that's what our public policy should be. If we are interested in creating low-income housing, then we should give the nonprofit industry as much opportunity as possible. But at the same time, it folds in an opportunity for other corporations or other investor interests to participate in it at the same time. It's one of the things that I've tried to argue for years. Nonprofits alone aren't always the best way to solve our public policy desire to create low-income housing. If we can get more private investors into that mix or private contractors, which this bill doesn't go in that direction, but if it would, you're putting more opportunity out there and you're allowing the nonprofits to continue building a very narrow part of our housing market.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witness. Let me see if I understand. So you've got a housing, affordable housing project X that costs $180,000. The first half of the money you raise by selling the tax breaks that the federal government provides. So that money's there. Then you have to go out and raise the other half of the cost, and the reason that people invest in that is because of the return, whatever income that project's going to generate. You're reducing that other half by the sales tax on the construction materials are about $2,000. So instead of raising 90, you got to raise 88. And it's just a mechanism to help get that other half of the funding. And just as a curiosity, does this tie anything? I understand now with the cost of building supplies going up that the supplies is getting to be a bigger and bigger percentage in its relation to labor. Does that play into this at all, or is that just something that's going on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scho. yeah, it does, of course. I'm not sure it's the impetus for it. The impetus is just to be practical about making it a tool for the primary way we provide affordable housing in the state. I just should say the other 90, by the way, the most common investors in the other 90, not the corporation investors, but the other 90 comes from, in part from, for example, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, sometimes a city that in which we're doing the development, sometimes foundations, sometimes the Federal Home Loan Bank, sometimes a variety of other Metropolitan Council if it happens to be in a high transit area. So it takes us 3.5 to 4 years typically to do these developments, in part because there's so many entities that we have to go out and get the money from. But you're correct that it's just part of that other $90,000 that we're trying to make happen.
And, Mr. Chair, that other $90,000, they get their return from the revenue stream that the projects generate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scho, actually the other $90,000, there's no return to anybody except a public community return of the affordable housing. Mr. Chair, Arthur. Senator Scho, I take it back. In some cases, there's a small debt service portion, a mortgage portion. If you approach 50% of affordable housing of AMI, area median income, and you go above that, sometimes there can be a small debt portion. But if you go down to where the real need is, there's often no debt portion at all. And in that case, there's no return on that other than 90 to anybody, except to the public for the MHFA, the Federal Home Bank, for others just to invest in affordable housing in our communities.
Senator Ortman.
Question for you. If say the house is $180,000, you get the 90 and the 90, right? The 90 that's invested by the private investor and the 90 that you're trying to raise, it doesn't take you as much if we give you the sales tax exemption. Now you only have to raise $88,000. Or you've got more money available for your construction. That's the cost picture. But the distribution picture at the end is still the 99 and 1, right? If you're a 1% general partner and you've got a 99% investment, you're distributing through the 99%. It could be cost savings because of the sales tax exemption, or it could be that you spent that extra $2,000 to buy a better house. But the 99% does not change.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, that is absolutely correct, that if we don't otherwise deal with that IRS requirement, then any distribution would be 99.1. That's on paper. What I can tell you is what happens, really, when we put together the limited partnership agreements, and you asked earlier whether or not the state had some requirements on that, and I'm not sure of them, mostly because I know that our requirements probably exceed any state requirements in that regard, so I haven't really figured that out, but it's a legitimate question to ask. We control the distribution by our actual limited partnership agreement. If it wasn't in the limited partnership agreement, it wasn't controlled by that, that would be the distribution 99.1. How we control that in our limited partnership agreements at Central Community Housing Trust, at least, and as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to find out if that's the state rule or not, is to require any funds left over to actually attribute to the long-term provision of those units as affordable housing. It gives us, the nonprofit, the first right of refusal to purchase the project within certain parameters. And what any limited partnership agreements we've had, when they've walked away with their legal costs paid, but really not anything more. So that's how we control that potential problem. You're correct. And whether the state requires that, I'd have to look into, to be quite frank.
Mr. Chair?
Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on even in these affordable housing, there would be some reduced rents or reduced payments or something. Where does that revenue end up in this mechanism that you're talking about? Because there has to be some revenue stream.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sko, this really is just helping raise the other 90. We won't even do the project at all if we can't come up with the whole 180. So the rent structure is going to be the same. It's not going to change. There's no additional money in the rent structure. It just won't happen if we don't get the 180. Let's say that there's a typical deal, which is $180,000, and again, we don't do these one unit at a time. These are 30-unit, 40-unit, 50-unit, 60-unit developments. The cash flow accrues to the benefit of the project, cover overhead costs, sometimes overhead costs of the general partner, but none of it gets distributed, in our deals at least, none of it gets distributed to the limited partner corporation investors from a cash standpoint. They get the piece of paper that says they get the tax breaks and depreciation. Those are the two benefits they get.
Mr. Allen, on a monthly basis, when you collect the rents, where does that rent go? Does it go to pay off a loan, or where does that rent go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, this ownership. Let's say rent for a two-bedroom. In the marketplace right now, the average rent for a two-bedroom is, believe it or not, in the Twin Cities, the average rent for a two-bedroom unit is $940 a month. This low-income housing tax credit tool typically reduces that rent by somewhere between 25 and 30%, because we don't have to pay debt service on half of the project, or really 90% of the project when we get the other funds raised. Because we can eliminate debt service, we can eliminate it down to just a little bit more than the cost of operating. So maybe we can limit it to get it down to $700, $720 a month for a two-bedroom unit, somewhere in that ballpark, $750 maybe. That cost covers, that $750, say, covers maintenance, management, real estate taxes. Our organization paid about almost $1 million worth of real estate taxes last year. Water bills, all those kinds of things that it cost, management fees to property management companies, for-profit property management companies, management fees, overhead, all those kinds of things are part of that $750. A little bit of reserves so that when the water heater goes out in 8 years, we can replace it. That's where that $750 goes on a monthly basis, typically.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogomar.
I remember this debate now. There's actually less here than there appears. This is really such a minor change that it seems like something really significant is going on here. But all this does is allow the vehicle that is mostly being used nowadays for affordable housing to use the tax break that was intended for this purpose. That's really all that's going on. It really doesn't change the investor's decision whatsoever as to whether they invest in these vehicles or not. That's what's kind of confusing about this.
There's a lot less than here than it meets the eye.
Mr. Chair.
So what's usually going on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I believe that is correct, except to say that it's been my pleasure to be able to explain the low-income housing tax credit program to you and how affordable housing in some crazy way happens in our state. But basically, I think you're right.
Senator Orman.
Mr. Chair, I would say there's no way to argue, however, that it would definitely affect the bottom line. And you can't get around that. Small or large, it affects the bottom line. I'd like to see, I don't serve on the committees that normally go over, you know, the need for affordable housing. But it seems to me that housing starts and new housing is down.
Yeah.
And it's not being driven by demand right now. There is not a demand for new housing. Now, whether there's a demand for affordable housing, I'm not familiar with that, and perhaps there is. And I know we want people to be able to afford homes. I think we have the highest home ownership rate in the country in the state of Minnesota. And so I'd like to see more of some kind of information about the need for this type of housing. And I'll keep an open mind on that.
Mr. Chair,
you
know, nationally, there's been a tremendous disinvestment in affordable housing. When we talk about home ownership and owning homes, we're talking about people who could even get themselves to the point of qualifying for a home, Senator Ortman. And these are people who are but, you know, one application away from being homeless. We have a housing crisis in the state of Minnesota. We don't have enough, not homes, to be owned by families, but we don't even have enough affordable units for working families, sometimes two-income, minimum wage working families, to be able to afford a home. And this is not even a home ownership situation, but to even be able to afford a rental property. That's why the governor headed up the homelessness project, because he recognized that there is a homelessness issue in the state of Minnesota and that there's been a tremendous disinvestment at the federal level, as well as the, I think, decrease in our ability at the state level to continue to supplement that because of our budget deficit issues. So we've been able to try to put mechanisms in place to get the private sector to participate as much as possible. But, you know, if we really want to do something about housing, maybe we should just take it out of the general fund and fund some more development of affordable units. There's not been construction. I mean, talk to the public housing authorities. There's not been any new public housing units developed in however many years. And with the cuts in Section 8 vouchers at the federal level and with the disinvestments to the public housing authority, we are in a housing crisis. We're in an affordable housing crisis, and that's why programs like this were put in place, and that's why we need to continue to look at how we can support them.
Well, Senator Moy, I think the larger problem is the wage gap. I mean, it's just the fact that we aren't paying people enough. And if we could do something to raise wages, we wouldn't have to build affordable housing, but we seem to be slipping and slipping and slipping in that area. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moy, I am very sympathetic to the concern that people can't afford places to live. Extremely sympathetic. And I think that we need to find a way. But there's something unseemly about profit-making partners in the concept of our attempts to create more affordable housing. And that's the thing I'm getting at. I agree with you that we have to find more ways to provide affordable housing. I think we should have general partners and limited partners, but I want to make sure that all of our money is being used to further the need and meet the need, and not to just line pockets of financial investors.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a public policy argument that could be made in almost all the tax policies that we address. I think, you know, not that long ago, we had in front of us Thompson West, who had come to ask us to give them, from a tax policy perspective, some incentives to continue to operate here in the state of Minnesota. On an any given basis, we use tax policies to incentivize people to want to do a number of things for the state. So I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, if we were to have the business industry here, they would say, give us an incentive and, you know, we'll continue to operate in the state of Minnesota. If we want to make it unseemly to say, why would we do something like that? It'll just continue to line their pockets and increase their profit margin. I think the public policy here is that sometimes we'll have to do some things that we don't necessarily like or that it's necessarily always absolute. If it's a good policy that goes towards a good end. And so I don't know. I think that, you know, once in a while we just can't be righteous and be absolutist about the kind of public policies that we make. The reason why we look at the things that we look at in this committee is that once in a while it makes good sense to do some things for the right reasons, even if it does cost us a little bit. So,
Senator, well, I don't know who's carrying the Thompson West bill, but I suspect we'll probably be having a hearing on it. I know they've been around to see many of us, and I think it was mentioned in the governor's budget overview, but I suspect we're probably going to be hearing that. Anything else, committee? Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Arthur,
Chair.
Thank you for coming
down.
And members, I apologize for the kind of short agenda today, bringing in on a Monday for only four bills, but the chair has another commitment at 10 o'clock, and I thought it might be helpful if we could get at least four more bills off of our plate here this morning. We're going to use up one day of our committee time this week for a budget forecast overview, a joint meeting with the Finance Committee, so we're going to lose one day. So appreciate your willingness to come in on Monday morning and get a few things out of the way before 10 o'clock. Senate File 706, sales tax exemption for vending machines for milk, water, fruit, juices, yogurt, and salads. Something similar has been in front of this committee for a number of years.
That's
Representative Layton?
It's true, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rob Layton, and I represent the Minnesota Automatic Merchandising Council, which is an association of distributors of food and beverage vending products. And with me today is Peter Jude, who's the current president of the council and whose family has been involved in the vending industry for over the 50 years. And I'd like to make just a few brief comments regarding this proposal and then turn things over to Peter. As Senator Bach indicated, Senate File 706 is a proposal we've introduced this year. It's actually been dubbed the Healthy Foods Initiative, and it's a bill that is important because it addresses an issue of unfairness in the present sales tax policy in Minnesota. What this bill would do is simply exempt from the sales tax the six healthiest items that are presently sold out of vending machines. That would be milk, water, fruit, 100% fruit juice, yogurt, and salads. And the reason for that is that under current Minnesota law, those exact same items, when they are sold across the street from a vending machine, if they're sold in a grocery store or in a convenience store, those items are not taxed. But across the street, if they're sold in a vending machine, they do have a 6.5% sales tax. And we think that that's a matter of unfairness that needs to be corrected. I also want to stress that this is a proposal that has had strong, widespread support from a variety of groups. It's been supported by those groups, individuals who favor a greater consumption of healthier items, whether that's schools, school boards, past proposals that dealt with milk and water, and strong support from the Minnesota Milk Producers Association, from the dairy industry, and in fact, last year the chief author in the House was Representative Greg Blaine, who was one of the few remaining dairy farmers in the legislature, and he was a strong supporter of this proposal. I'm going to have Peter Jude talk about why We believe if this legislation were to pass, it would have an impact on the types of items sold to students and sold to people around the state and why it would be beneficial. This proposal has had support in the past. With regard to milk and water, it's had support both in the House Tax Committee and in the Senate Tax Committee. Senator Pogemiller was an author of the bill last year. Provision was included in the Senate tax bill. In previous years, it was supported by Representative Krinke, and there's a provision for sales tax exemption in the House tax bill, but we've never got it done together in the same year, and I'm hoping this might be the year that we can do it. And I'd appreciate your consideration of this proposal. And I'd like to turn things over to Peter Jude for a few comments.
Hi, I'm Peter Jude, and as Rob had mentioned, I'm the owner
of... Mr. Jude, tell us who you represent.
Okay. I represent myself initially. I am a vendor out of Maple Lake, Minnesota, which is rural. I am also president of our state association, which is the Minnesota Automatic Merchandisers Association, which is our state vending association. There's actually three benefits. First of all, I'd like to thank the Senate committee for supporting our bill in the past, and namely Senator Pogemiller for being our chief author last year. But there's three areas that I see this benefiting. First is the tax issue, the fairness in the tax issue, as Rob had mentioned, but also then to consumers and also to schools. And namely the tax fairness issue is that as a vending association, we've always struggled with how our products are sold through the vending machines that are subject to tax, when many of the same identical items that are sold in convenience stores and grocery stores are not taxed. And it's this continuing inequity in the sales tax that applies to both these food and beverage items that Rob had mentioned that brings us actually here to ask for this exemption today on those items. But also how it can benefit the consumers is it might not seem like a lot, but it could also be a reduction in the prices to the water and milk items. And maybe it's only a nickel or a dime, but again, it does add up. And it also would allow the vendors to want to offer more healthy items in the machines, knowing that maybe there is a financial benefit for them. But it would, which would be good. But also to the schools, just in exempting these items from the sales tax would actually give most of the schools an automatic increase in their commissions. And as I'm sure you're aware, most of the commissions are used for extracurricular activities in the schools, and that would be an automatic. One thing, too, is this might be a concern, is how would we keep track of the water and juice items that are sold. Is, again, most of the vendors have an automatic inventory control system where we're all computerized, and it's easy to keep track of the items that are sold through our vending machines. But also, I'd like to just thank you again for your consideration and your time. So,
Mr. Jude, what would you think that if in the bill we mandated that in school contracts that the sales tax savings be passed on directly to the school, so the school gets the total benefit of it?
The one downside that might be is maybe there wouldn't be a reduction in the price. And I think our one purpose is to allow items maybe to be sold at a reduced price to the students to help get their consumption up on some of the healthier items. And already initially, if you just take the sales tax off of it, normally in a normal commission situation, you actually back out the sales tax. So if I'm selling something for $100, you take the sales tax off and you pay the commission on that. Whereas now it would be a lesser amount of sales tax as a reduction, so they would automatically get a higher commission. And then the schools do negotiate their contracts with their vendors, and it would give them an opportunity to increase the commissions.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, on that point, because I think it's important, the point you're getting at and the point that Mr. Drew's making is that he doesn't know about every contract in the state, but most of the contracts he's aware of, the way it works is that you'd have the gross revenue sales, you would deduct the sales tax before you got to the amount that the commission would be based on. So under this proposal, if you didn't have a sales tax on those items, the schools would be getting the benefit of that because the net amount that their commission's based on would be the higher amount because you wouldn't be backing out the sales tax.
But Mr. Layton, wouldn't the the commission is split between the vendor and the school district. My point is, why don't we just pass on all the savings to the school rather than just a percentage of the savings? If you can think about that. Senator Scoy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm I mean, the rationale for this is to try and get kids in schools and other Minnesotans healthier foods than Papa, I guess. And you were talking about the cost and that this, if we give this exemption, it'll go right to the price of the product. When I look at this list of products, you know, milk and yogurt and salads and probably fruit juices, I don't know about fruit, probably fruit also, they have a shelf life. Could you talk just a little bit about the cost of this and the cost of the that sort of stuff, just a little real short summary of what's going on with these products that's different than some of the ones on the that are pop and soft drinks and candy, etc.
Mr. Jude?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Senator. On those items, the sales tax that, let's say, would be saved on those would be used to reduce the price. When you take a salad out of in a vending machine, you know, the shelf life is 3 to 5 days. And, you know, if I'm going to offer a salad, maybe I would stick one in a machine. But if I know I could sell it at a reduced price, which chances are I'm going to, so I don't have to throw it away, if let's say, the exemption were there on the salads, maybe I would stick two in that machine, and maybe one of them would sell just at a lower price, because anything that is left in the machine, we do throw it away, and it does cost us money. And so maybe the options that we're offering are more limited because of our throwaways, whereas this could give us an incentive to possibly.
I was wondering, Mr. Jude, maybe you should have one more little button to push on the side of the machine that says day-old salads or something. Maybe they'd be marked at 50% off. Senator Moy?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jude, I wondered if on an industry-wide basis, has there is there a link? I don't know. I mean, I have nieces and nephews who are, you know, in junior high and high school, and Lord knows. I mean, I don't know what would incentivize them to buy really healthy stuff next to the candy and the pop. And has there, on an industry-wide basis, have you been able to show that if the price went down a little bit, that the kids would necessarily eat more healthy stuff out of the healthy vending machines versus just going straight for the pop and the candy and the Mountain Dew and, you know, all the other stuff?
Water is probably a good example of that. Just with the price reduction in the water, and I think also the awareness for the students, too, they are more apt to buy the water at a reduced price than the pop. So we have seen that.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Jude. Mr. Layton, Chair Lee is over to Senate File 706 for possible inclusion. Tomorrow morning, members, 8:30. This committee's adjourned.